From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. March 19, 2003 brought shock and awe, the aerial bombardment of Baghdad. March 20th brought the invasion. 10 years ago this week, the United States brought its military down like a hammer on Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. Did we do it for democracy? For the people of Iraq? To take out weapons of mass destruction? For strategic gains? Because it would be quick and easy? For oil? None of those have turned out well. We taught one brutal man and his cruel crew a lesson. Did we teach ourselves anything after all the costs? What have we learned? This hour on Point, the long lens of a decade on the invasion of Iraq and all that followed. You can join the conversation. What did we, should we learn from the war in Iraq? And what do you see now in the long view? Will we do it again in Iran? Is that different? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. 10 years ago this week, President George W. Bush announced the beginning of the military engagement in Iraq.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
Opening stages of a war that turned out to be much longer and costlier than many anticipated on that day, 10 years ago this week. Joining me now from Washington is the Atlantic's national correspondent, James Fallows. He wrote and thought about and gamed out the Iraq War well before it began and has recently been taking stock on the 10-year anniversary for the magazine. You can find links to his posts at our website, onpointradio.org. James Fallows, it's good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And with me in the studio is Nathaniel Fick, a former Marine Corps officer who led 2nd Platoon Bravo Company of the 1st Reconnaissance Battalion into Iraq during the 2003 invasion. Before that, he was a platoon commander in Afghanistan. His book on Iraq and more, One Bullet Away, was a New York Times bestseller named Best Book of the Year by the Washington Post. He went on to become CEO of the liberal-leaning National Security Think Tank, Center for New American Security. He's now CEO of Endgame, a cybersecurity firm, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Nathaniel Fick, Nate, thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be here, Tom.
Jim Fallows, first to you, you've been writing a lot about this lately, getting a lot of thoughtful feedback from your readers as well. You say right off the bat that in your view, the Iraq War was the biggest strategic error by the United States since at least the end of World War II and perhaps over a much longer period. It is not hard to find people saying this was the biggest strategic military blunder this country has ever made in its history. Why? What justifies such sweeping, condemnations in retrospect of this war, James?
Well, I'll first make the limited case for the post-World War II standing. And if you're going to argue about the sweep of American history, you could say that it was the biggest unforced error of all. Mm-hmm. But certainly, let's compare it with the main contender, which would be Vietnam, which certainly was much more costly in American lives, in America's sense of itself, and all the rest than Iraq was. But Vietnam seemed to me a more understandable decision, and that year by year, month by month, through the early 60s, there was an extension of Cold War logic for a number of decisions that on their own seemed understandable at the time by the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, whereas the decision to invade Iraq was in my view, wholly unnecessary, wholly willed distortion of American foreign policy away from the target of that moment in Afghanistan, where al-Qaeda was, of course, away from the international concord that surrounded the United States, just almost without exception after the 9/11 attacks, and opening up what was foreseeably a very, very difficult campaign that's had the quite mixed results we've seen. So I think that it was a completely unnecessary, extremely costly diversion of our policy.
Let's look at that cost. An enormous strategic error only matters if it has costly consequences. People are talking in such dire terms about the meaning of this war. How do you look at the costs? And I know there are many, but let's dwell on them for a minute here. If it was an error, an unforced error, with what costs as we look back over a decade?
Well, if we're talking strictly in the financial realm, you'll recall that Lawrence Lindsay, who was in those days a financial and economic advisor to George W. Bush, was forced out of the administration for hazarding the view that the war might cost something in the vicinity of $100 or $150 billion. It looks as if the long-term costs are at least going to be 10 or 20 times that much. So that's simply financial. It's also
a couple of trillion plus.
A couple of trillion plus, and the decision to go to war was made at a time when the main fiscal problem for the U.S. Federal government seemed to be surpluses that were going to be too large. That was the prevailing view early in the George W. Bush regime before the beginning of these wars and also the introduction of the tax cuts. The more profound costs, I think, are not simply the human beings in America and Iraq and elsewhere whose lives have been lost or permanently changed or otherwise damaged, but also, I think, to America's sense of what its military purpose is for, how its military would be used. This is the first sustained military engagement since the end of the draft in the late Vietnam era, and I think we've seen what I refer to as the cynical sort of chicken hawk nation mentality succeed that, where lots of people can be...
We lost Jim Fallows for a second there, but Nate, that brings us right to you. I mean, you were there in the military. What about this notion that somehow this has taken U.S. military purpose, its sense of military purpose, off into, I don't know, the desert? You were there in the invasion. What about the consequences for the U.S. military and those who serve looking back on this war?
Yeah, if I start talking about the consequences of this decade of war, I inevitably have to start with the human cost. More than 4,000 American dead in Iraq, more than 30,000 wounded in Iraq, and these are multi-generational costs. An all-volunteer force is older on average than a conscripted force, and that means it's more married, it has more children, and so the number of kids who lost parents in Iraq is staggeringly high. And these are costs that we're going to keep bearing actually long after the nation's balance sheet is put back in order.
So there you were on the ground as you went in 10 years ago this week. Were you caught up in the whole sort of wave that much of the country had been whipped into by all the talk of, weapons of mass destruction and threat and necessity?
I remember sitting in the Kuwaiti desert in February of 2003 before the war began, and our only connection to the outside world was a hand-cranked Grundig shortwave radio. And so we'd gather around a fire at night and listen in to the BBC's World Service, and we listened to Colin Powell testify before the UN General Assembly, and we listened to protests in Washington and London and Berlin. And what really struck me, actually, in those moments and the conversations that followed was the professionalism of the people on the ground who were there, because we could have a debate about the merits of the war. Should we be doing it? Should we not? How did it compare to our experience in Afghanistan the year before? But at the end of the conversation, everybody put their opinion away and recognized that we, as volunteers, had sworn an oath to obey the lawful orders of a democratically elected government.
Yep.
Full stop. You don't
yep.
want the guys with the guns making the decisions.
And over the 10 years of this war, the soldiers who were with you there, the Marines in the field, how do they look at this? Do they look back? And you were early. Many came later. It got messier. It got much uglier. It got much harder. Do they look back in pride, in bitterness, in a sense of how could our leaders have taken us into something that turned out to be so different from what was painted at the outset?
I think it's a full spectrum, Tom. Some of them are dead. Some of them have
been
wounded.
Let us not forget.
All of them who were married are now divorced. So the human cost at an individual level, I think, has been extraordinarily high. And that's a cost that's been borne by a tiny, tiny fraction of our population.
Mm-hmm.
The war started 10 years ago, but it ended less than 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for many of us, it's still too close to really have considered judgment about what the cost is overall or how what does it mean for the nation overall. Will this be seen in time as a major war, or will it just be a skirmish that's part of a broader campaign?
Boy, if that's a skirmish, $2 trillion plus maybe in cost and lives and reputation. James Fallows, I think we've got you back. You were looking at the chicken hawk nation that I think you were saying kind of emerged as an American frame out of this war, and maybe the ultimate strategic costs for the country.
Yes, and sorry for the line drop of America's crumbling infrastructure, which took me away. I heard what Nathaniel Fick was saying about the human cost to the people who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course that is profound. And I think what is worrisome in a civic sense is that, as he was saying, is that that is confined to such a small fraction of the American public. And I think one reason why it's being more difficult to take the lessons from this past 10 years than it might have been after Vietnam or after some other military, even after the Korean War, is that most of the American public and also the decision-making machinery and opinion machinery in particular is not reminded every day, either financially or in human terms, of the cost of this mistake. And so I think we haven't seen the sort of thoroughgoing reassessment we actually saw for this half a decade or more after the end of the Vietnam War.
You write about, and we'll look at this, but you write about how those who led the country into the Vietnam War suffered a very real kind of ostracism that must have led to some deep soul search. And we know it did in many of their cases. Out of the Iraq War, anything comparable, James?
Boy, I think not. I was if you think of the poignant example of Robert McNamara, who as anybody who's seen The Fog of War, this wonderful Errol Morris film from a couple of years ago, or read any of the Vietnam War histories, know how he was, of course, centrally involved in the decisions that went wrong in Vietnam, and for the rest of his life, this was an ever-present factor in his existence. He went and did sort of public penance for a while as president of the World Bank, and when he finally wrote about his Vietnam decisions, it was with obvious anguish. I would contrast that with Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, or the others, from whom we've seen nothing like that degree of introspection.
In fact, Dick Cheney saying on the Showtime documentary just in the last few days, "I'd do it all over again in a minute." James Fallows, please stand by in Washington. Nathaniel Fick with me in the studio. We're looking at the Iraq War 10 years after the American invasion. Listeners, you can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Iraq War 10 years this week after the American invasion of Iraq. Lessons, costs of what's being widely called the biggest foreign policy military blunder maybe in American history, certainly in a long, long time. James Fallows is with us, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's been writing about what we've learned and how it looks through the long lens of 10 years now since the war began. As my guest Nathaniel Flick says, only two since it ended. It was a long and costly engagement. Nathaniel Flick was in the Marines, went in the invasion, had just come from Afghanistan, went to Iraq. His book, One Bullet Away, The Making of a Marine Officer, about that time in our military history in Iraq and beyond. Many sacrifices made by American servicemen and women, by Iraqis as well, and as it went on, it got ugly. Here's April 2004, 60 Minutes 2, broke the story of the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. soldiers and contracted interrogators. The photographs out of Abu Ghraib prison riveted and revolted Americans and people around the world and became perhaps the most damning piece of evidence of America's critics offer for the gap between our claims of exceptionalism and our actions. Here's then-CBS anchor Dan Rather reporting.
The pictures show Americans, men and women, in military uniforms, posing with naked Iraqi prisoners. There are shots of the prisoners stacked in a pyramid. And in most of the pictures, the Americans are laughing, posing, pointing, or giving the camera a thumbs up.
It was painful, painful to look at, and the whole world looked at it. The cable channel Showtime aired a new documentary last week, The World According to Dick Cheney. In it, former Vice President Dick Cheney showed no regret, no second thoughts about the 2003 invasion and all that followed, the torture, civilian deaths, and more. Here's Cheney from the documentary.
It is a wartime situation. It was more important to be successful than it was to be loved. If I had to do it over again, I'd do it in a minute.
He'd do it in a minute. Many Republicans no longer so sure. The libertarian group Young Americans for Liberty held a conference earlier this month in Raleigh, North Carolina, and GOP Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina looked back on the Iraq War, talking about responsibility for its consequences.
Congress will not hold anyone to blame. Lyndon Johnson is probably right in hell right now because of the Vietnam War. Probably needs to be voted for Dick Cheney.
Lyndon Johnson's probably rotting in hell right now because of the Vietnam War, and he probably needs to move over for Dick Cheney. That from Republican Walter Jones of North Carolina. Jim Fallows, what about the reckoning for this war and how it has and has not been made paid?
This is something I've tried to reflect about a lot for both backward-looking and forward-looking reasons. I think backward-looking, it is the case that a relatively small group of people, both in politics and significantly in the press, were from very soon after the 9/11 attacks directing American attention to the idea that there had to be this attack on Iraq as opposed to Afghanistan or any other place that had been more directly involved in the attack on the United States. And that had such an effect on American standing in the world, America's military fiber, the hunt for al-Qaeda, et cetera, that something should be reckoned with there. But it has not. And here is why I turn that in a forward-looking direction. If you look at the lineup of people who are sort of egging on and cautioning about some kind of showdown with Iran, whether it's by Israel with American approval, overt or tacit, or whether it's by the United States itself, it's essentially the same lineup of people. The same strategic thinkers, the same politicians, the same media outlets are saying, yes, there's this threat from Iran, which really is mounting, which we have to get rid of before it's too late. And I think part of this argument, which is different, of course, from Iraq, but is similar in its overall contours, there should be some sense of how do these people judge? How does this group's judgment stand up 10 years ago in similar warnings, including Vice President Cheney, who very famously said at, I think it was an American Legion conference or something in the summer before the war, that we know beyond all doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction and there's no question about it. And that flat out statement of something that was not true is something that should count.
Nate Flick, you were in the Marines. Looking back on it now, how do you look at the cost, the strategic costs of this war, and maybe if you see benefits, let's hear them as well. And what about the leadership that took us into it?
Yeah, let's focus on the benefits for a moment. I do think there have been a few. And one, perhaps, is the Iraq War in many ways broke the Republican stranglehold on national security credibility in our politics. And since the Truman administration, almost without interruption, the Republican Party has been the party of national defense in the United States. And that is no longer so clear. I think you see a schism developing in the
Republican
Party.
Because of a credibility problem that emerged there, or the divide within the party?
Well, it's twofold, right? It's a divide within the party and a credibility problem with how the Iraq War was advocated for and then handled. But also, for a generation, the Democrats basically abdicated responsibility on national defense since Vietnam. And that's changing now. You see more Democratic leaders wearing the mantle of national security. And I think in a democratic society, we want both of our major parties to have some national security bona fides.
Does it matter which party wears that mantle? Is it equally likely to go in under bad pretenses and at high cost if it's Democrats? What are you suggesting?
So I mean, that gets to the question of whether any of these lessons will actually stick, right? And unfortunately, I think that history would suggest that we will forget most of what we've learned. But there'll be a handful of people who will be in our decision-making in the generation to come who were directly influenced by this war, in the same way that there were people on both sides of the aisle influenced by Vietnam. And more often than not, they tended to be the voices of moderation in the run-up to this war.
Jim, I want to dwell for another moment here on cost of this war. Nate and you have looked at it at the personal cost, the cost mm-hmm. in life, those wounded, their families, the financial cost to this country of support for them and the whole operation that will go on for decades. But, you know, there I think many Americans have the sense, well, despite all of our problems, we're still such a big country, we can kind of roll on. And even if this was an 8-year war that was in many ways a bust, we can handle the cost of it. It's all right. It just gets folded in somewhere and forgotten. Is that true, or are we bearing an acute, real cost strategically?
I think both of those are true in this sense, that the United States still has overall assets that are superior to the rest of the world. So, as you know, we've discussed many times, China and both its strength and its limitations. The European zone is having all of its crises. Japan, where we both lived, has its own reason for sort of shrinking influence, et cetera, et cetera. So the United States still is the predominant power. Nonetheless, I think that the cost to us is profound. I'd say there were a number of pivots there. The decision to go into Iraq Iraq was the time when the United States, as an economic enterprise, switched from feeling as if it was going to have a permanent surplus problem to having a permanent deficit problem, which now governs our problems. I think in a moral sense, it's worth recognizing what this did to America, and we may eventually recover, but it's something we have to recover from.
And I would say globally, domestically, what do you mean by moral sense?
In the moral sense, I mean both globally and domestically, with things like the Abu Ghraib photos, which you were mentioning.
And facts.
And photos and facts, and the sense that around the world there was the idea that America, for all of its flaws, was the country that didn't torture people, that didn't run these secret prisons. We haven't even talked about the civil liberties effect within the United States. Yeah. The presidential executive authority has been growing monotonically since the end of World War II, but it took its real step increase over this last 10 years. So in terms of our strategic reserve, our moral the moral cushion and how we're seen around the world, our own sense of how a republic operates. And I think in all those ways it was a profound harm.
The American reputation as, which of course was not universally held in any case, but there was a kind of gravity to it, as the good guys, Jim.
The good guys who made some grievous mistakes. You know, Vietnam was, by the last 4 or 5 years of it, was not popular around the world. The United States is far from a universally beloved country. But there was some sense that there was a line that across which you didn't expect American troops to pass. And we passed that line, at least in some instances.
Let's go to our listeners. Steve in Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Jim Fallows touched on it a moment ago, but I think you need to delve into this more, and that is the lie about what the intelligence showed about weapons of mass destruction. Many people have said, our former senator here, Link Chafee, has said publicly, I've talked to him privately, that when he went into the briefing with the intelligence people, with other senators who were too cowardly when they came out to vote because of how they were backed in by the timing of this thing in the fall before the war, that there was no there, and that the intelligence briefers, by their nonverbal looks, were indicating that they also knew there was no there. So this shibboleth about everybody knew that there were weapons of mass destruction, it's just that it was a lie then, and now there are people like Stephen Hadley perpetuating that lie and saying, of course, we all, at that time we all knew. The Clinton administration knew, Republicans knew, Democrats knew. They didn't all know.
Steve, I appreciate your call. Jim Fallows, let me bring that to you. I'm looking here along those lines at comments made recently by Paul Pillar, who was with the CIA, calls the Iraq War one of the worst and most inexcusable blunders in the history of U.S. foreign policy. And he, like our caller Steve, says, you know, look, there's still people saying that, well, the intelligence was just bad. Pillar writes, intelligence did not drive or guide the decision to invade Iraq. He says the Bush administration cherry-picked fragments and turned it into a case for war, Jim.
Yes, I think the evidence supports that interpretation. And to go back for a moment to the cost of the United States, back when Colin Powell was giving his famous testimony in front of the United Nations, many people made the analogy to Adlai Stevenson, who was then the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And when he showed photos of Soviet missile sites going into Cuba, the argument was nobody doubted for a second that those were true, that they meant what Adlai Stevenson and the John F. Kennedy administration were saying at that time. It was a very dangerous episode, but the U.S. credibility was there. Now, the next time the United States shows photos of some alleged WMD site in Iran or anyplace else, the main image will be the last time the world saw that intelligence, and it was not true. It did not mean what the official U.S. officials said that it meant. And my understanding of the decision to invade Iraq was that it was essentially set a week or two after the 9/11 attacks. Before there had been any of this WMD, even alleged parsing of intelligence, the idea even then was we've had this festering problem with Iraq for a long time. This is the casus belli which will allow us to go back to this source.
Even though there was essentially no connection to 9/11.
The only connection was a rhetorical one that Paul Wolfowitz and others were extremely eloquent in making in those first few months, and saying that there is this worldwide sort of swamp of terrorism, and the main place, where the only way to deal with it in the long run is to drain the swamp. And from their rationale, Saddam Hussein was sort of the main alligator in the swamp, or whatever a model you want to use.
Though terrorism had not been his modus.
Exactly. Yes, and so it's by the time the argument for the invasion was being made, the WMD claim was drowning out most of the other reasons, because that was the one that was essentially unrebuttable. You know, the rest of us on the outside couldn't say, well, we know that stuff false, even though now we know that it was. So that began to trump the many other reasons that within the administration, reasons both, quote, idealistic, unquote, and less idealistic, for thinking this was going to be their response to the 9/11 attacks.
Then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice saying, of course, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud, but there were no WMD. We're looking at Iraq, the Iraq War, 10 years on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Charles in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Charles, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. First, I'd like to thank Nathaniel for his service. And obviously, the Iraq War was a very costly and awful and horribly mismanaged affair. That kind of assumes that any war is anything but that. I mean, the Vietnam War was a good example of how not to do it, and so was the Iraq War. But the end result, on top of all the things that did go wrong and terrible things that happened, is the Iraqi people are now on a path to democracy. So given all of the things that happened and the price that was paid by Americans and Iraqis both, is that not enough? And would the same result like Iran not be best?
Charles, we're losing you, but let me take it first to Nathaniel Flick. Nathaniel, you get the gist of that. Look, war is ugly, but here we are all these years later, and two things there. A, Charles asserts Iraq is on a path to democracy, and B, asks, is that enough? So is it on a path to, is it there? Is it on a path to democracy? Is it, Nate? And given the enormous costs we're describing here, is that enough?
I think Iraq has probably reverted to being a normal Middle Eastern state with all of the problems that entails. But the bigger issue for me is the degree to which our foreign policy should be driven by messianic zeal. Should we be motivated by trying to do for others what they cannot or will not do for themselves? And my general answer is no. I think that that takes us down a very slippery slope, and it's not the standard I would use when thinking about applying American power. So you know, was it enough? Is it enough? Probably not, in my estimation.
I mean, if it's just become another Middle Eastern, what kind of authoritarian state? If that's what you're suggesting, that's far from the kind of city on a hill image that President Bush was describing. We're going to bring this new era.
Well, sure. I mean, let's not forget, there's sectarian violence in Iraq almost every day. There are car bombs and shootings killing dozens of people a week. We care about it less now because American forces aren't there, but it's still happening. The Iraq War is in some ways still playing out, not only inside Iraq, but in the region. And so I think it's too soon to tell what the long-term effects are going to be.
Jim Fallows, all war is ugly, so don't get so overwrought about this. And, you know, it was an effort for democracy that made some progress on that. Maybe that's enough.
Let's consider this from the point of view of how a democracy is supposed to function. Suppose that the argument made in 2002 and early 2003 from the Bush administration had been, let's go into this country for the next 8 years at the cost of many thousands of American lives, the cost of trillions of dollars, recognizing there's going to be side effects of certainly abuses and torture and all the rest, and the using up of our military, so that a decade from now, this country can be still, it won't have Saddam Hussein anymore, but it'll be riven by sectarian divisions in a way that it never was in its recent past, and so that Iran's influence in the region will be greater. Imagine George W. Bush making that case for invading Iraq in 2002.
I don't see Congress on its feet in response to that message.
Right. I mean, the only argument that sort of forced Congress's hand is the Condoleezza Rice one of the warning cloud. It can't be that the smoking gun can't be the mushroom cloud. That was cynically the argument they made because they knew there was not a way to rebut that.
James Fallows at The Atlantic, please stand by. Nathaniel Fick, who was there at the time of invasion, please stand by. We're talking about the Iraq War 10 years after the American invasion. Listeners, you can join us. What's the real long view here? How do you tally the costs, the lessons? Here's the sound of taps played at a 2010 Memorial Day ceremony in Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Iraq War 10 years after the American invasion. Lessons, costs of what's being widely called the biggest foreign policy, military blunder, maybe in American history, certainly in a long, long time. Nathaniel Flick was there as a Marine officer, first in Afghanistan, then for the invasion of Iraq. He's with me in the studio today, author of One Bullet Away. James Fallows is with us, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's been writing very interestingly, with lots of reader feedback. You can link to all of his posts at our website, onpointradio.org. Costs of many kinds, $2 trillion plus, just financial costs to reputation around the world, to our strategic standing, and of course, individuals and psyches. Post-traumatic stress disorder in returning soldiers has soared in this country in the last decade. Here's CBS reporter Randall Pinkston reporting the findings of a 2010 study on PTSD.
A study found that about one in five U.S. troops is suffering from major depression or post-traumatic stress from service in Iraq and Afghanistan. By the numbers, that comes to about 300,000 men and women.
That's a big number. Let's go to Nathan in Springfield, Massachusetts. Nathan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. My comment is 10 years ago, it's about how much we've changed as a country, and I've changed personally. 10 years ago, I was a senior in high school. I watched live on television U.S. forces cross the border into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after that, I graduated high school and I joined the Army. And I've deployed to Iraq twice.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, I'm out of the Army now. But I was very gung-ho about the war, much like most of the country was.
Yep.
Back in 2003. And my first few months in Iraq, I realized that this wasn't this big, you know, glorious thing that the media and our politicians have made it out to be. And that changed my views personally on the war. And I'd like to think that this thing has, you know, gone on for 10 years now, that the average American's view has also changed, that it shouldn't be this easy for us as a country to decide to go to war and to support our politicians who go to war on, you know, questionable, at best, intelligence.
So, Nathan, you were there. What would you like from your fellow countrymen and women, from your leaders, the next time out, the next time it's the war possibility is raised?
Look, we, America, one of the great things about America is that we have an all-volunteer service, and I think that's the way it should stay. You know, people like me and you know, millions of other Americans throughout history have volunteered to, you know, give our lives if necessary for our country. But I believe that our politicians have a responsibility to make sure that our lives are used responsibly.
Amen to that, Nathan, and I appreciate your call very much. And your service there as well, Nathaniel Fick. What are you thinking as you hear that soldier call in? You know, he was there, he answered the call, and he and many others I'm sure had their misgivings. Many paid a big price.
I think you know, most of the guys I served with who were there would agree with him. And I think these are opinions that were earned the hard way. So here, and thanks for the call.
Nathan, thank you. John in Antioch, Tennessee. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a couple things I want to say. The first is that the suffering and destruction of the Iraqi war is not basically the problem of the United States, that we suffered from it and had PTSD and all this, but it starts with the suffering of the Iraqis, who didn't actually do anything to us, had no involvement whatever with 9/11, let alone a weapon of mass destruction, and they had countless dead. We hear about the prison and the soldiers torturing and ridiculing Iraqi prisoners, as if the suffering there was, you know, our suffering. But the people who were suffering there were, of course, Iraqis. They were the ones who
yes.
were in prison. Then the other thing I have to say is that the lying which led up to this is so extraordinary it's impossible to summarize. And it comes down to the fact that Bush, Cheney, Wolfowitz, and the rest of those guys were just executing their plan to transform our country into what it is now. So,
and by that you mean a country with, fewer fully realized civil liberties than before?
Well, there's that. There's the privatization and expansion of the prison system. There's the acceptance of a stop and be searched for everybody everywhere, a culture of suspicion of American people, and then just closing your eyes to the huge military expenses.
Hey, John, let me take you back to your point on Iraqi suffering. What about the fact of Saddam Hussein being kicked out? How do you look at that 10 years on as something that the United States did for Iraq?
No, obviously not. All the money was earned by Halliburton. Where's the oil? Why didn't the United States set up a partnership between Iraq and the Western oil companies to process and ship their oil out of the country and make them rich? Why did we let it burn on the ground and spend our time bombing and killing Iraqi citizens?
What's your answer to that? Surely it wasn't just sadism.
No, I think it's a kind of a neo-Nazism. The very word shock and awe is it's incredible to me to hear that term shock and awe. And to remember Bush talking about a preemptive strike. I was brought up to believe that the United States would never execute a preemptive strike.
John, I appreciate your call from Antioch, Tennessee. I mean, Nate, there's the deep empathy for the Iraqi people, a dictator gone, but John's not giving us the country much credit for that, given the suffering that was around that.
Yeah, I think John and I would disagree on a lot of what he says. The notion that Halliburton or oil services firms profited from this war is, almost demonstrably untrue. Oil sold on the global market. I mean, this is, there's not a pipeline in Iraq pumping oil
but
into
Halliburton
American.
Halliburton had huge contracts for support of the war effort, not just drilling.
Absolutely. But the notion that we let oil burn on the ground instead of shipping it is crazy. I mean, there was a massive amount of effort put forward to make sure that the wells didn't burn the way they did in 1991. The notion that the U.S. let the oil burn and focused on bombing women and children, as John says, is just not true. So I'm kind of reluctant to engage on it.
But, Jim, Iraqis certainly paid a heavy price for the chaos and violence that followed the invasion.
They did. And I think the assessment of, is Iraq overall better off than it would have been if Saddam Hussein had been left in power 10 years ago? That is a complex question that's hard for Americans, or at least for me, fully to assess, because you have all of the damage and destruction and sectarian strife that we've seen in the past 10 years. You also have the fact that Saddam Hussein was abusing different groups of people when he was in power. I would separate that question, which is in a way unknowable, of whether Iraq overall is better off or worse now, from the question of was it worth it for the United States to shift the state of Iraqi better offness from the Saddam Hussein state to all what we've left there? And to my mind, it clearly was not. One other point about the arguments for the war, I think point of view of the people advocating it, like Mr. Wolfowitz or Cheney, mm-hmm. or President Bush, essentially everything was pushing in the same direction. They thought this was anti-terrorist. They thought it was also a way to fulfill a long-term suspicion about Saddam Hussein. They thought it would work out quickly. They thought it would bring democracy. And so everything, it was a much easier decision for them than it should have been.
But really, none of those turned out. I mean, even on the oil front, I'm looking here at a story that Western oil companies are barely bidding now on oil contracts in Iraq. This thing is just too tough an environment for them after all these years. Elizabeth in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just want to agree with the, unfortunately not with your guest, who mm-hmm. doesn't think that the whole thing was to make Halliburton rich. Cheney says that he'd do it again in a heartbeat after everything we've heard about that war. I can't imagine that anyone would do that unless they personally were gaining. And there's no doubt about it, I've heard from many sources that before the troops were allowed to go and start the war, they were sitting burning in the desert as the temperature was getting higher. And in Washington, there were lawyers dotting the I's and crossing the T's, making licenses so that Halliburton would be the only ones who would be able to do anything for great amounts of money out in Iraq. even our allies were not allowed to help out in any way whatsoever unless they went through the Halliburton people and probably had to pay for the privilege.
Elizabeth, I appreciate your call. Certainly lots of private contracting there. As my guests say, that has changed the complexion of how the military works in many ways. Let me get one more on the Bush administration here. Donna in Peacham, Vermont. Hi, Donna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been listening, and I thank you for the time to talk about this because it's very close to a lot of people's hearts. I think, for me, the loss of human life is it's inconscionable that these politicians and people in charge have not been brought to responsibility. They it seems that we just go on and on, and they don't have to be responsible. No one said to them, well, you have to be accountable for this. Bush, Cheney, anybody who was involved. And human life is the most important thing that we should be thinking about before we do anything, not making money. So to me, it's an unethical thing to send someone into a war where they could be killed, wounded, their families, everyone is touched by this, and that they are not accountable.
Donna, pointing straight at the moral issues in a war, by many accounts, gone wrong. Donna, I appreciate your call as well. We're looking at the Iraq War 10 years after the American invasion. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Time grows short. Let me get one more call. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air. Looks like we lost Carl. Jim, one of the big issues you raise here is threat inflation. How looking mm-hmm. at, yes, Saddam Hussein was he was brutal with his own people, and many saw him as a bigger problem than that for the United States and others. But when we get into a situation of conflict or fear, there is this dynamic of threat inflation that can easily outstrip reality. It did here. How do we look at that 10 years on?
This was something that actually surprised me as I looked back at the documents of 10 years ago and realizing that through the entirety of my conscious life as a proud member of the baby boom generation who was sort of first aware of public life during the Kennedy and then Johnson administrations, that every single time we've had public warnings of some imminent military threat, those warnings have proven to be false or inflated. The one time that was actually most dangerous for the world was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964, in almost everything involving the Iraq buildup, in the Soviet missile gap, and I would contend also about Iran now. Well, we don't know about Iran. We know looking back, there's been a consistent bias all in the same direction. And I think that's worth bearing in mind as we assess the warnings from Iran.
What about that, Nate, as we look at Iran right now? And, I mean, there are efforts in the U.S. Congress to tie the United States to Israeli policy so that if Israel goes to war, we essentially go to war as well. Talk about taking this further away from the American people. But what about the lessons of Iraq as we look at Iran? These are not carbon copies, and yet there are dynamics here that could work similarly.
I agree completely with Jim that our bias tends to be to threat inflate. In looking at Iran, though, we have a few things that make it different. First, maybe we have a basket of tools at our disposal that's very different from those we had a decade ago. So,
what do you mean by that?
Well, the U.S. is already involved in essentially a war with Iran.
You're talking about the web viruses that we've planted and more, but you've got a lot of military people saying, if this goes on to war, this won't be just played out with web viruses. This would be war. And some are saying it would not just 8 years, but decades with major costs for the U.S.
All the more reason to wage, to use these different capabilities, the sanctions, the attacks perhaps on Iranian scientists. There are other things underway that have the net effect of keeping Israeli strike aircraft on the ground. And in my estimation, going to war, kinetic war with Iran right now would be catastrophic. And what's more, it probably not even successful. I mean, the great lesson of the last decade has been not to pick a fight with the United States unless you have nuclear weapons. And so the perfectly rational course with Iran is to distribute and harden their nuclear facilities and get the centrifuges turning. So the more we can do to forestall the need for a kinetic campaign, the better. Without, hopefully, allowing Iran to cross the nuclear threshold.
Kinetic war, a phrase itself that I associate with the last decade. Americans come and understand that as bullets, bombs flying, ultimately boots on the ground, but most likely. Jim, how do you see this playing out? The people, there are many of the same people, are still in our national conversation. No small number now pushing for a tough stance on Iran. What about the American public, Congress, the White House, and its what after effect of Iraq when we look at the at this next potential front of conflict?
I think the main benefit of having been through this this failed decision 10 years ago as we look to Iran will come from reminding people that we've seen similar arguments, although different in detail, as Nate Fick is saying, 10 years ago, and just trying to say, okay, as we look at warnings, options, decisions about Iran, which people are saying which things, how did their judgment 10 years ago stand up, how would they, if they made flawed judgments 10 years ago, why would they say we should listen to them now? So I think that is the main benefit I can see of this this terrible choice we made a decade ago of clarifying our discussion now. And I hope we do involve the Congress and the public much more than was the case before.
Do you think it's clarified enough after all these years of staring at Iraq that the country is significantly less likely to be buffaloed or stampeded into another flawed military conflict, Jim?
The short answer is no. I think that there's many reasons why whatever lessons we take from Iraq have been blurred. Blurred partly because in the public's mind, the Iraq and Afghanistan experiences sort of run together, partly because the outcome in Iraq itself is so confused, partly, as we were discussing earlier, because most people who are not in the military are sheltered from thinking about this very hard. So I hope we can bring some clarity to it.
Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's been thinking and writing extensively about the 10-year anniversary of the Iraq War. You can link to all of his work at our website, onpointradio.org. Jim Fallows, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Nathaniel Fick, who was there in the Marines into Afghanistan, into Iraq, wrote about it in One Bullet Away, now CEO of Endgame. Nate Fick, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. You can continue the conversation at the website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.